Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Nicolas Poitier.
Scott Marcus.
Daniel De Fugulis.
And in this episode of The Sound of Economics, we will discuss the reopening of the European economy linked to the COVID-19 pandemic. Since the end of May and throughout the month of June, many European countries have lifted or loosened the lockdown measures set in place to fight the spread of the virus. One of the last measures still in place is the closure of international borders, which, to some extent, brought back to the memory a closed Europe and border checkpoints, which many of our listeners that have born after 1989 probably haven't never experienced, at least on the scale we have had in those months. As this is somewhat an atypical and historical moment, I'm going to embark myself in a peculiar journey starting on Friday, 12 June. Together with David Labby and Andri Afritson, we will try across 7 countries and more than 2,500 kilometers to collect facts about how the border closure affected the economy and society, take a temperature reading of the perceptions of people, and make an analysis out of it. It is an exciting endeavor that sees Bruegel on the road after these months of lockdown and countless Zoom live streams. And it will help us to see the impact on the ground also of the European policies, which are more of a commonplace in our studies and in this podcast itself. You will be able to follow us on the road on the Bruegel channels as well as the project website, www.reopeningeurope.com. But promotion aside for the project, the conversation that we will be having in this episode is not only going to be an interesting exchange on the topic, but also for me, a learning opportunity to take important notes for the inquiries that I will make on the field trip. I feel a bit like an ancient explorer who, before setting the sails for uncharted territory, is going to receive a brief in the port where the ship is moored. So thanks a lot, Renilde, Nicholas and Scott, for being here today. I would like just to ask your first impressions and your first thoughts about the journey that I am going to embark on in a few hours.
So I think it's a great idea. We here at Bruegel, we're doing social distancing at the moment, sitting at home, doing a lot of Zoom meetings. And I think it's exciting to hear a bit from actually how that looks like. We look at data all day. We look at the measures that are taken all day, but actually how they implemented on the ground. That's very interesting for us, for our research also to inform.
I think it's a really good research that you're doing, you and your colleagues, Giuseppe. We're at a point now in Europe where reopening is possible. We've had a reduction in the number of new cases. We've had a reduction in the number of deaths. We're making progress. It's warranted now. I think it will be important to see how things are changing, and especially to see where things are going to go. In the past, we've had very disruptive events. We've had 2 world wars. We've had a return to normalcy after each, but it wasn't the same normalcy. Both world wars in Europe enormously accelerated progress in aviation, also in other technologies like mass production of penicillin. The way I like to think of this is by way of a Zen Buddhist parable. It's that before achieving enlightenment, rivers are rivers and mountains are mountains. Upon achieving enlightenment, rivers are not rivers and mountains are not mountains. After having achieved enlightenment, rivers are rivers and mountains are mountains. But one suspects there's a difference. The normalcy that we're likely to return to won't be the same normalcy. Things will have changed. And some of the areas where I think this is especially visible are areas like telework, teleconferencing, telemedicine. Things won't be the same. And in some ways, that'll be positive. What we're living through today is a very, very dark cloud. But that dark cloud has a silver lining.
Thank you, Scott. That sets really the frame of the discussion indeed. Renilde, what is your first thoughts about this project?
First of all, I'm very jealous that I cannot join you.
car.
But following up on what Scott was mentioning, I do think it's indeed very important to see this crisis not too pessimistically, but as an opportunity for going into a new normal here. But that will very much depend on what the power is of the people, whether they have actually the energy and the ideas to go to that new normal with new ideas, and whether they will be supported. And I think it's really very important to have a feel of what the people actually feel. Do they see this? Do they have ideas? Do they see ideas? Do they want to take it? Or are they feeling very pessimistic and very careful and are constrained? Because that will make all the difference between whether we will have this crisis as an opportunity for a next new wave or whether we will go down.
Indeed. Indeed. But let's go back a little bit on the background. Where do we stand now, and what actually have been the consequences of the closure of the borders, of the lockdowns, and so on? Because that's where we will start. That's our baseline to a certain extent. And when thinking about closure of borders, the first time that comes to my mind, obviously linked to the European project, is the fact that one of the greatest achievements of the European Union itself has been the creation of a single market, and that's probably the most long-lasting or long-term kind of endeavor that we have been having since 60-70 years in Europe. So I'm kind of looking at Niklas because he could enlighten me a little bit about the consequences that what we have been seeing in the past months have had on the single market itself, on value chains, European value chains, and what do you think I should expect to observe when I will speak with a local entrepreneur or a cross-border worker, or any other people that I will find along the way?
Yeah, so in the single market, we have what's called the four freedoms, which are the freedom to movement of capital, labor, goods, and services. And these also kind of mirror the aspects of globalization that we have, the globalization of capital, the globalization of labor, of personal movement, of travel, then we have the movement of goods, and then finally the movements of services. And of these four movements, I think capital was likely the least affected in that sense. I mean, we have seen a big crash in the stock market, but many stock markets have recovered. There are now problems with capital movements in emerging markets, but in European Union, I think so far, as far as I can tell, actually there have been no capital controls or problems there, unlike the financial crisis. But actually, there have been big disruption in the other three freedoms. So we have around 1% of European workers move across borders, live on one side of the border and work on the other. And I guess this is something I hope to hear from your report, is kind of how do people experience that at the border? We have seen that many countries have closed their borders and they're just now opening up. It's very different case by case how this actually is enacted and how strict this is and what are the exceptions. But generally, it became very difficult to move. And air traffic basically has come to a standstill, which used to be, especially for longer distances, one of the main modes of travel. And this actually affects also the movement of goods. So if you close down a border, also you cannot go with a lorry and move goods through the European Union. We have seen a change in demand for goods. One example, sitting here in Brussels, is that people now don't go to restaurants anymore because they're closed and they cook at home. But French fries, which is a big export good actually of Belgium, are not consumed that much at home. And now they actually have to probably throw away the renews. They have to throw away a lot of potatoes because they don't have enough space to store frozen French fries and potatoes anymore. So there's changes in demand. The European Commission has been, I think, relatively successful in opening up what's called green lanes, that goods can move through the European Union. And I think in a lot of consumer goods, we have seen delays, but they were not massive delays or massive. So basically, apart from toilet paper, we still see the same goods in the supermarkets, more or less. But it's very different for companies. So what you saw were factory closures, that basically many factories cannot produce at the normal rates. We have seen a massive crash in demand. People are very cautious about doing big investments, and especially in something like cars, which is a big investment. If you don't know if you are employed in a few years or in the next months, you will not do such a big investment. At the same time, we see this all around the world. So this has affected, you might not be able actually to get your workers. So the trade in goods has been affected in that sense. Also just the availability of goods, the demand for goods.
So sorry, just I want to interrupt you to understand a little bit better this. So for example, if a factory has been closing down in Lombardy because the infection rate was higher and they had to close down before or for longer period than a factory in, let's say, Germany, this has had an impact on the German factory as well. If the factory in Lombardy was producing parts or was linked to the production cycle of the German factory, correct?
Yes. So I think the way we have to think nowadays about European manufacturing is just as being one big system. So it's not true that, so people think of Volkswagen as being one company that builds a car in Germany, but that's actually not true anymore. So it's one company, and a lot of what they do is actually just the supply chain management. They have companies producing for them. All the different parts you might find in a car are produced by different companies in different parts of Europe. And they all come together in Wolfsburg, or not actually in Wolfsburg. Many of these factories all over Europe now, but let's say in Wolfsburg, and then they are put together to the final product. And what the company like Volkswagen actually produces is the engines and actually the final thing, put the thing together. But many, many of the parts, the seats, the dashboard, whatever, are produced by suppliers. And actually, we have seen in the last decades a shift to what is called just-in-time management, supply chain management, where the idea was kind of like your stock of goods. Like before, you would have basically, you need car seats, so you buy 10,000 car seats, you put them somewhere on your grounds, and then you put them in the cars one by one. Whereas now we have this just-in-time production, where actually the street is my stock. So you say, okay, we order 10 seats every day, and they're going to be in the streets for 10 days, and this kind of alone gives me some kind of, I don't have to have a big warehouse full of this stuff anymore. And that leads also to the problem now that in the moment this kind of the street is closed. This doesn't work anymore. This, the moment one of the factories is closed, if you don't have a warehouse full of stuff, the whole supply chain is disrupted. And since we're so interlinked in within the European Union, that means actually that the whole supply chain is in trouble. So the problem with that is that kind of the response to the crisis has been very national. And I think the European Commission has been fighting. They have gotten a lot of bad press, but I think not all of it is warranted. Since healthcare is a competency of the nation states, they have been fighting to create what is called green lanes, where basically cargo can go through, even though people cannot go through. And so I think that was quite successful, but still, they're just the fact that borders are closed, that demand is down, factories doesn't work, still disrupt these chains. And then maybe to the last point, Scott might say something a bit about how services changed. Basically, air transport has come to standstill, and air transport is actually not unimportant for freight. Basically, under each Ryanair plane that you fly with is a big empty space below the passengers, which is normally filled with goods. If the flight doesn't fly anymore, these goods are not moved anymore. And the services are like, I would think, I don't have the data, the breakdown, but I would expect services trade to be more affected than goods trade in the end. Because many of the things, tourism, flights, they are just disrupted, and they will be for feasible future. Even if we close, open the borders, do people want to have vacations in Italy?
You have a very clear explanation about what has been going on, indeed. And when you speak about services and the fact that people haven't moved and they stayed at home, there are some stuff that continue to roll. You know, there are things that continue to function. Some stuff in terms of delivery of goods, you mentioned about the green lanes and so on. But others have been possible also because, let's say, some of the traditional services have been cut through innovation or like digitalization from the fact that people have been able to continue to stay in touch and work and continue to meet remotely. And this has been one of the big features, I think, of this lockdown. And and links it up. I mean, before the lockdown, and I'm looking at Scott particularly, we've been having a lot of discussions also here at Bruegel about the future of work. We've been speaking a lot about robots, you know, like we thought that, I mean, of course, it's still a very, very relevant and important discussion. But our main focus was about robots and about are they going to steal the jobs of people? While maybe we had less or overlooked a little bit, if I may say, the impact of other innovations that could happen in terms of how the work of the future or the work of the present is actually looking. And on this, I would like to recall what Arthur C. Clarke, a science fiction writer, which many knows because he was collaborating with Kubrick for 2001 Space Odyssey, actually wrote the script of it. In a segment from a BBC program in 1964, he said, trying to predict the future is discouraging hazardous occupation. But then, when he was saying something about the future of the workplace, he was saying it will be possible for a man in the 2000s to conduct his business from Tahiti or Bali just as well as he could from London. And then he said, in fact, men will no longer commute. They will communicate. And it's kind of funny to hear the quote from C. Clarke from 64. And here we are in 2020, and we've been locked in and you know, in front of our computers for a few months, and still now recording this podcast in a remote environment. What's your take on this, Scott?
Well, I'd start by saying that Arthur C. Clarke was a very clever fellow. He not only had this perception, he also was probably the main inventor of the geosynchronous telecommunications satellite, the idea that communications could be driven by satellites that seem to sit over the same part of the Earth every day because they revolve around the Earth at the same speed with which the Earth rotates. So he was a clever lad, and I think he got a lot of this right. Now, in terms of how work is evolving and how communication compares to transport, there's always been something of a race as to whether transport would improve faster than communications. And communications has made enormous strides with the growth of fiber optics, undersea cable, and internet, of course. And we see that today. People who are forced to work from home, forced to do things from home, find they can do more than they thought they could or more than they realized they could. We know this at Bruegel already. For years, our own workshops had been sent via video conference to a broad public, but we were still conducting the physical events, and the speakers in almost all cases were sitting in our offices in Brussels. Today, we can't get them to our offices in Brussels. Well, we're starting to be able to think of it again. But what most institutions like ours have discovered is that we can do it all remotely. And that has advantages. It not only represents an ecological gain, we're not burning up, we're not creating CO2 flying people around, needlessly, one could say, but it also means that we can get speakers from further away than we normally would. In a recent event for Bruegel, I had a speaker from the West Coast of the United States who probably wouldn't have otherwise been a speaker for us. So there are clear efficiency gains. What we see in the numbers is the amount of traffic to video conference services like Zoom increased by about a factor of 20 from February to April of this year, because people needed to do more conferencing. Some of that's professional conferencing, but some of it is me talking with my relatives in the United States and elsewhere. And a lot of this could have happened before. All of the technology has been there for years. This is not really new, but necessity is the mother of invention. People who are forced to use the technology are finding they can do far more with it. We see a similar evolution with e-commerce. Before, you might go a few blocks away to buy some electronic component that you needed. During the lockdown, the store was closed, so you bought it instead online. Some of that business went to Amazon. A lot of it didn't go to Amazon. More of it went to smaller e-commerce providers. But people found that they could do far more online than they realized. And that's likely to remain. Some of these changes are likely to remain. Again, if I think about Bruegel's own program, we probably won't go back to a 100% physical program. We're probably going to have some kind of mix between virtual and physical events. Many of these are likely to be durable changes. There are also going to be changes in the nature of work. Perhaps I'll come back to that in order to give others a chance to speak.
Great, Scott. I mean, you make exactly one of the main point of the things that I would like to try to find on the ground is like, there is a reopening, but what kind of reopening? Are we going to get back to business as usual? Or the business is actually not only affected negatively, and this has to be, you know, repeated and documented. And of course, we need to take care about how the people on the ground are experiencing the effect of not only the health effects, but actually the economic fallout of the pandemic. But on the other hand, and it will be interesting to observe and see if there are indeed certain accelerations in business model changes and disruption and innovation. And here I look at Reinilde, because she is an expert on the topic, to tell me a little bit more about how does she sees this this new normal. I mean, as you pointed it out, or like, how do you see the process, at least? What kind of process I should actually trying to observe if I go into a specific location to trying to get some signals about these disruptions?
So if we look at and think of innovation, I think perhaps the most famous mind on this is Joseph Schumpeter. And he introduced this notion of creative destruction. Never waste a crisis, because although we have destruction, it also creates the room for creation, and actually creation needs first destruction too. Of course, that's a very challenging perspective, but I think it also applies in our case now too. And so the creation is also something, and the innovation is also something that we really need in order to be able to adapt to the new normal that will not be the same as the old. So we will need new products, new services in order to be able to deliver a new kind of society that we will be living in, where there will be way more need for distancing, digital distancing. And I would like to tie that also, this new normal will also include way more climate-friendly environments too. So that's also part of the whole restructuring too. So in this respect, the question is, when we are thinking of restructuring and the recovery plans, do we really look enough forward and take into account what we need in terms of new normal? Or is the emphasis really on, in the restructuring and the recovering, let's avoid any bankruptcy. So let's keep as much as possible what we had before. And I think, although of course it's also important to avoid bankruptcy, I think there should also be way more forward looking here, is that we also make sure that that there is enough room and support for those new creative activities that can take place in existing companies that are restructuring, but also in completely new companies here, and particularly also the generation that's just graduating. They also, we should really avoid that they would be a missed generation here, that they can actually also start new activities and new jobs in this new here. And I think that's a very important point where policy should also make sure that by protecting too much the existing structure, by protecting those that are already there, should actually not make it too difficult for these ones here, and actually also make sure that you set the direction and give the right incentives for these creative minds with new products and services to be able to survive here. But also these creative minds need to be assured that their new products and new services will find enough uptake too. So in that respect, I think it's also very important that we as citizens also will be willing to take up these new services and new products here. So we also need enough optimism and trust by consumer side here to create enough demand for these new products and services as well here. So it is quite challenging, but I'm pretty sure that European citizens do have the creation and the trust and the confidence and the gut to go for that new one.
So how do you see in practice this kind of balance? Because on one hand, when we speak about avoiding the bankruptcy of existing businesses, it's not just about the businesses themselves, but it's also about the people that are employed by those businesses. And we've been seeing in the past a lot of problems that goes around when there is a huge risk. I mean, Nicholas before mentioned a change in production line, which we had already like 30 years ago from you know a vertical integration to a just in time and you know a different setup, which laid off a lot of workers at that stage, and we're still like in. I mean, we are still in the shock of that transition in Europe, if we might, you know, say things as they are, you know, because that's also part of the discussion that has been going on in terms of generations as well, you know. So how that transition can be managed in that specific challenging time of a pandemic that is loosening its strength, but it's not yet finished, and where there are other shocks which are still going on also at the global level.
Yeah. I think so. So you rightly point out it's all about managing the phases and the transition. Of course, initially we needed really to make sure that all these the big negative shocks were really taken care of with avoiding bankruptcies that were purely due to the shock. That's basically a pretty easy process here. But now we're moving to the next phases where we want to get ready for the new take-up. And that's a way more difficult process here, because that's not just avoiding losses here. That's really also making sure that you don't protect too long, because the longer you protect them, the more difficult you will make it for new ones here. And also you would have to set also the direction that in which this new will take place here. That's very clear that clean and health and distancing that need to be put in as kind of conditions of support or removing any barriers, particularly for those kind of activities that you want to support here. And that's way, way more difficult, although not impossible. So we do have already before the crisis, we already had a policy that was trying to stimulate digital and green here. So we do know how to do this, but what's most tricky is the timing. So making sure, I think that's the most difficult one, is actually not taking too long protection of the existing companies here, avoiding restructuring, letting loose that protection in order to create enough space for the creation. That's the most difficult one.
Scott, I saw that you were nodding and at the same time wanted to add something on this.
Thank you. Yes. Well, job disruption is something that was in the cards anyway. You'd mentioned robots a few moments ago. The expectation has been that the advent of robots and artificial intelligence will alter a large fraction of all jobs. There were predictions a few years ago that it might actually destroy as much as 40% to 50% of jobs. Most people don't believe that today, but almost all jobs will be altered in one way or another. And this had implications even before the crisis. The crisis maybe magnifies or accelerates some of these. But clearly, the response has to be in terms of retraining the population. It has to be in terms of a shift from traditional education to something that looks more like lifelong learning. And some countries do this better than others. Some regions do this better than others. I would have to say Europe as a whole is not doing a great job with lifelong learning. It's something that we need to do better. But some countries, for example, apprenticeship systems, countries like Germany that have far more occupational training, seem to do a better job than others. And it's probably something that we need to put more focus on going forward. We would have needed to anyway, but the crisis, I think, accentuates that need.
On these, the importance of retraining and reskilling, I think that's really important. And it also puts a lot of pressure on the education system in order to be able to also restructure. And there I have to say, since I'm also teaching at the university, we have been really very sluggish in terms of adopting digital technologies for education. And but this crisis has really provided a big shift in that. So now digital teaching, blended teaching, everybody is adopting it so fast now. And I think and I hope it will also be used not only to address how we teach our current students, but also for continuing education as well here. So I'm hoping that the crisis also has provided a shift of opportunity for the education sector to address those new services that are needed.
Indeed. Nicholas?
Yeah, so I think basically on what Scott and Hilde were saying, I think if we want to reimagine our economy, which you had to do anyway, I think the crisis can be a catalyst. So the reason that we don't have a very competitive digital sector, I think, is basically because there's a lot of golden cows that individual countries don't want to give up on. And if you think about a digital service versus an industry, you need a physical infrastructure, you need roads, you need bridges, you need trains and this kind of things. And this you can actually manage at the local level. But actually, if we think about the digital economy, service economy, why is the reason that we actually all sit in Belgium and Germany instead of the beach in Spain and Italy is basically that we don't have a real digital single market in the way we would want to. Regulation is really important in this kind of services. And there actually there's been a lot of resistance in kind of reimagining our economy, kind of Europeanizing our digital economy. And I hope that this is kind of a catalyst, that here this is the moment people recognize that for being the future of economy, we need a common European market, not just in physical goods, but also in the digital realm.
Scott, final words?
Yeah, just the last word. I think that what Nicholas said is really, really important. Again, telework, I think, is something that's seen a huge explosion over this COVID period, over the last few months. Telecommuting, again, was technically possible for a long time. I mean, a lot of white-collar professions could be done just as well from home. Why haven't we seen more of it than had historically existed? A lot of it was resistance from companies. They feared a loss of control. At this point, they've been forced to deal with it. They've adapted their processes. I don't think things are going to go back fully to where they were, and I think it's very positive that things have made this transition. It's moved things along, accelerated things that otherwise might easily have taken decades.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. Well, thanks to all of you. We are coming to an end of this episode for your inputs. And I have to say that they were extremely useful for me to understand and for our listeners as well. I think they really set the frame about what we will find across the road. Let's see how the inquiries go. Also, our listeners can follow the developments of our endeavors along the trip on the website www.reopeningeurope.com, as well as on the usual Bruegel channels and the Bruegel website www.bruegel.org. So thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to The Sound of Economics, and until next time, bye-bye.